Stanley and Livingston, two of the most famous names in exploration in Africa, and often linked together, although one was a journalist and the other a missionary. So tonight, the 10th of November, we mark the anniversary of when Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingstone at Ujiji, commemorated by this stone, which has got David Livingstone written on it, and in the cross of Africa with David Livingstone's vision for Africa. There's a marker to the right. We've been there in Ujiji near Lake Tanganyika in Tanzania. Under the mango tree which then stood here, Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingstone 10th of November 1871. 10th of November is significant for many reasons. Today is Martin Luther's birthday, 10th of November, 1483, but also 10th of November, 1871, historic meeting. Henry Morton Stanley was one of the greatest explorers of all time. In fact, he stands head and shoulders above all other explorers in terms of the vastness of the areas that he surveyed against the most incredible odds. Throughout his incredible life, which was packed with adventure and conflict, he served as a soldier, a sailor, a journalist, an explorer, an empire builder, a statesman, an author, politician, lecturer, and finally, he was even knighted by Queen Victoria, which, considering his origins in Wales, absolutely extraordinary. Stanley is most famous for having found missionary explorer Dr. David Livingstone after he had been out of contact with the outside world for many years. His calm and most understated of comments, after having crossed half the continent, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume," must be one of the most famous statements in popular memory worldwide. Throughout his life, Henry Morton Stanley experienced brutality, cruelty, starvation, disease, poverty, affliction, treachery, betrayal, ultimately great honor, success, and wealth. Of all the great explorers of Africa, David Livingstone and Henry Morton Stanley stand head and shoulders way above all the rest. Stanley and Livingstone were very different people, but both of them made spectacular contributions to the development of Africa. And what's also extraordinary is how one came from Scotland, the other came from Wales, both from very poverty-stricken backgrounds, although Livingstone did have a loving family, Stanley did not. But what they achieved against all odds is extraordinary. Stanley stands out as the only journalist who founded an empire. In my travels around in places like Australia and around Europe and America, I've asked different journalists, who would you say is the greatest journalist of all time? Most times they don't have a clue. Sometimes they mention some very contemporary journalist. And I say, no, I'm talking about of all time. You can't compare some Washington Post characters who broke the Watergate scandal with the greatest journalist of all time. I mean, you've got to be kidding. That's just a big story in our time. But what did they actually do to achieve that? What risks did they take? And so on. How can you compare their impact on the world with what Stanley did? And most journalists I've spoken to from Australia to America have agreed, you're right, Henry Morton Stanley is the greatest journalist of all time. There's no close second. Although his primary occupation was meant to be recording history, he is most famous for having made history. Stanley stands out as extraordinarily tough and persistent, a model of perseverance. Yet before his 24th birthday, Stanley had a long track record of frustration and failure, defeat and desertion. No one could have predicted how this extraordinary man would develop and rise above all others in his achievements, especially in bringing civilization to the Dark Continent. He might be much maligned today, but he was much praised in his generation as the greatest humanitarian, the greatest emancipator of all time, who saved more millions of lives from barbarism, slavery, savagery, cannibalism, so many others. What he did to bring civilization to huge swaths of Africa is unprecedented. The life of Henry Morton Stanley is full of surprises. And the first surprise is he wasn't born with the name Henry Morton Stanley, but as he was baptized John Rowlands. That's believed to have been the name of his father. Stanley was born in disgrace, the illegitimate child of 19-year-old Miss Elizabeth Parry. Of course, there shouldn't be a disgrace to the child, to the parents, but that's the way society was then. Shortly after his birth, 28th of January, 1841, his mother abandoned him into the hands of her father, in other words, his grandfather, Moses Parry, and ran off to London. Economic disaster had reduced this old gentleman to living with his sons in a small cottage and working in a butchery. When John was just 4 years old, his grandfather died. His two uncles were unwilling to care for this illegitimate nephew, so he's taken by the hand, walked to a huge stone building surrounded by a massive iron fence. At the door, John was astonished to be seized and dragged inside. That was the goodbye he got. The door slammed and he soon learned he is now an inmate of St. Asaph's Union Workhouse, an orphanage to confine unwanted children. This workhouse was to be John Rowland's home for over 9 years. No time was wasted for sympathy for the homeless and for the unwanted. The life in St. Asaph's was hard and grim. It was described as charity with a vengeance. The rigid routine began at 6 a.m. every morning, continued till 8 p.m. in the evening, when they were locked in the Spartan dormitories. In between there was work, lots of it. The boys swept the ground, scrubbed the floors, worked the fields, shivered in thin, inadequate clothing. The meager meals consist of bread and gruel and rice and potatoes in small rationed portions. Saturdays, they were scrubbed. Sundays provide the only relief with two church services, no work. The schoolmaster was an ex-miner, James Francis, who, having lost his hand in a mining accident, had developed a vicious temper and a callous heart. James Francis apparently took savage pleasure in punching, caning, kicking, whipping, and beating the children entrusted to his care. John Rowland received his first flogging, that means whipping, for failing to pronounce a word correctly. The institution averaged 30 boys at a time, averaging from 5 to 15 years. The curriculum was described as primitive. John vividly remembered the day when a young 11-year-old boy, Willie Roberts, strikingly handsome with curly hair and a delicate face, was beaten to death. It was rumored he is the illegitimate child of a nobleman. John saw his corpse in the dead house. Mortuary. Willie was covered with dark bruises and deep gashes. All were convinced that James Francis had murdered Willie Roberts. John recalled that he never missed his mother. He said he was 12 years old before he even learned that every boy has to have a mother. Yet even this unforgiving and depressing environment, John managed to distinguish himself with his drawings, mostly of cathedrals, which, when presented to the bishop, earned him commendation and a Bible. John was selected to lead the workhouse boys' choir, and because of his exceptionally good memory, he was pronounced the most advanced pupil in St. Asaph's by the school inspector. One boy, who later remembered him, described John Rowland as stubborn, self-willed, uncompromising, unusually sensitive, particularly strong. When John was 15 years old, an event occurred that changed the whole direction of his life. Recalling it later, he observed, "But for the stupid and brutal scene that brought it about, I might have eventually been an apprentice at some trade or another and would have mildewed in Wales." The sadistic tyrant, James Francis, demanded to know who had scratched a certain table. When no one confessed, he seized a cane and announced he would beat the entire school. As they were commanded to strip, John refused to obey. Francis erupted in rage. "How is this? Not ready yet? Strip, sir, at this minute. I mean to stop this abominable and barefaced lying." "I did not lie, sir. I know nothing of it." "Silence, sir. Down with your clothes. Never again." John was determined. At that, Francis assailed him, beat him mercilessly, lifting him up, throwing him against the bench with such force he feared his spine had shattered. As Francis lay into him, John aimed a kick into the schoolmaster's face, breaking his glasses, knocking him unconscious as he fell backward onto the stone floor. As horror swept over the school, John fled over the fence to his paternal grandfather, a prosperous Welsh farmer. After hearing his story, he ordered his grandson to leave and never come back. His uncles were also hard-hearted. His cousin, Moses Owen, a schoolmaster in Bryanford, gave him some board and lodging, but his Aunt Mary berated the cousin, for taking John in. Moses Owen inspired John with a love for books and learning, but the other boys at school were merciless in teasing and bullying him as an outcast. Boys can be pretty brutal and sadistic with those who don't fit in, and having gone to all-boys school most of my life, I must say, bullying seemed to be a daily reality. After 9 months of schooling, he was taken to Liverpool, placed under the care of another aunt, Mary Morris. There he is given a job as a storeman in a haberdashery. After 2 months, he is fired and wandered the streets looking for opportunities for employment. One of these jobs led him to carry provisions to a captain, David Harding, of the Windermere ship. The captain spoke kindly to him and offered him a job as a seaman, as a cabin boy, basically. But once on board and seasick, he learnt that the captain's promise of him serving as a cabin boy was only a scheme to obtain cheap deckhands climbing the rigging. Now, of course, ships at that stage, you need people, especially small, light people, to climb up and down the rigging to arrange the sails, fold up the sails and all that. And on a tossing ship, that can be quite a terrifying job. And they liked young boys in their teens, sometimes even preteens, for that job. He experienced further abuse on board the ship, and at the first opportunity in New Orleans, on the other side of the Atlantic, he jumped ship. As the signs and the sights and sounds of America fascinated John, he met a kind-looking gentleman in front of a store. "Do you want a boy, sir?" The man was startled by the question. Now, the businessman was Henry Hope Stanley, cultured, intelligent, prosperous, happily married, but childless. Although John Rowlands was asking for work, the gentleman began to question him closely. He determined to adopt John Rowlands. "Do you want a boy, sir?" He meant, "Do you have a job for me?" But the man looked at it with another perspective. Mr. Stanley took him off for breakfast, followed by a haircut, kitted him out with decent clothes, employed him as an apprentice to Mr. James Speak, a merchant. And for the first time in his life, John was actually free. He had money in his pocket, room and board, a good job. He began to add books to the bishop's Bible that was his only possession up until then. He started to construct bookcases in his room out of old packing boxes, and he spent all his time reading books. The beatings and rejections that he had experienced throughout his upbringing had made him something of a social outcast. He was hypersensitive, uncertain how to behave in any social context. The first friendship he developed was with Alice Heaton, a runaway girl of 16 who had fled from Liverpool. She had managed to maintain her disguise as a sailor boy long enough to reach America. She must have made an impact on him because he named his main boat, which he went across the Congo River, all the way down the Congo River, the Lady Alice. When Mrs. Stanley fell ill, John left his job at the store and devoted every minute to the care of his patroness, the only woman who'd ever shown him any affection. That's how he described it. As Mr. Stanley was out of town on business, John was the only person beside her when she died. Feeling dejected, John obtained temporary employment as an attendant for a sick sea captain, went up the Mississippi River to find Henry Stanley in St. Louis. However, Henry Stanley had already departed. So John worked on a flat boat, meaning a, what we call a pontoon, basically just one of these flat rafts back to New Orleans, which was an adventure avoiding sandbars and steamboats and storms and dangerous currents and whirlpools. Good training for his later Congo River mission. In New Orleans, John was reunited with Mr. Stanley, and the first tender affection he'd ever experienced, he was embraced by Mr. Stanley. The next day, Mr. Stanley declared, "As you are wholly unclaimed, without a parent, relation or sponsor, I promise to take you as my son. I promise to take you and fit you for a mercantile career, businessman. In future, you're to bear my name, Henry Stanley." This is the beginning of what Stanley later described as the golden period of my life. For the next 2 years, the Welsh boy was educated, mentored by this kind gentleman, provided with his first toothbrush, first nightshirt, pajamas, first suits. He was taught table manners, frequent baths, intelligent conversation. The young Henry Stanley was expected to read constantly, often aloud and to discuss what he had read with his father. His father lectured him on morality, faith, work, culture, and customs. He taught his son how to think clearly and how to live uprightly. He taught him to be alert and to be observant. He would propose hypothetical problems, challenge Henry to suggest a correct solution. Henry Stanley proved to have a phenomenal memory and soaked up all the teaching offered him. One night in 1860, as they were traveling down the Mississippi River on a steamboat, Henry was on deck when he saw a man enter his father's cabin and threaten him with a knife. Henry leapt at the man, grappled him, putting the would-be robber, possibly murderer, to flight, suffering only a gash in his coat. Business required Stanley to now travel to Cuba. His last words to Henry were, "Hold fast the Christian principles and be fearless in all manly things." Working in Arkansas, the young Henry was laid low with malaria and fever. Yes, America used to have malaria. In fact, John Calvin suffered from malaria in Geneva back in the 1500s. So malaria used to be worldwide. At about this time, the war between the states was erupting, and he received a parcel addressed by a feminine hand containing a petticoat. This was pretty common. Women would shame men into volunteering for war. In the First World War, it often would be send them a white feather or hand them a white feather to church, suggesting they're a coward and, you know, chicken, that sort of thing. And so, stunned by the implication of cowardice, he immediately took action by joining the Confederate Army to resist the coming Yankee invasion. In July 1861, Stanley joined other Confederate volunteers in Arkansas as they were issued with flintlock muskets. Considering the Yankees all had cartridges and Winchester repeating rifles and weapons like that, just getting muskets was, they were obviously under-armed, and they couldn't reload as quickly as the enemy could. But that's what they got, flintlock muskets, and they embarked on a steamboat bound for Little Rock. During his time in Little Rock, he bought a Colt revolver and a Bowie knife. Very good investment. When the day came to march out with the bands playing and a woman cheering, Stanley was exuberant and eagerly looked forward to battle. Soon, with aching shoulders, blistering feet, sweat-soaked body, he began to discard half the contents of his backpack, learned the elementary rule of an infantryman, only carry what's absolutely necessary. You can do with a whole lot less. If you've got to carry it all day, you will soon work out what you really need and what you don't. For the first 9 months of his military service, Stanley's regiment marched. They marched across Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. Imagine 9 months of marching before you get your first battle. In April 1862, after marching for days in the rain, they arrived at what was to become the bloodiest battlefield of the American War between the states, Shiloh, where Grant and Johnson were going to be locked in battle. Confederate generals Johnson and Beauregard were about to throw 40,000 exhausted Confederate troops against 50,000 fresh Union soldiers under General Grant. Most of the Southerners were armed with old flintlock muskets, whereas most of the Northerners had modern breech-loading rifles with cartridges. Soon, Stanley's regiment, the 6th Arkansas Regiment, was ordered to march straight towards the center of the Union lines. The sound of the musketry increased in volume, intensity. Artillery shells were flying overhead, bringing down branches and debris on their heads. Soon they could see nothing in front of them but the enemy. The order was given, fix bayonets at the double quick. The men in gray gave a great battle cry, surged forwards, and as the gray figures, the blue figures before the gray began to flee before them, Stanley experienced the exhilaration of victory. He thought the battle was won. Actually, it had only just begun. Soon encountered even more Yankees. Volleys of deadly fire tore through the gray ranks. The ground seemed to erupt beneath them. The roar of gunfire was so intense he could barely make out any of the orders being shouted. The air was filled with flying metal. The sound of ricochets was all around. It did not seem possible that anyone could survive in the face of such a deadly barrage of lead. The command to dive for cover was given, and Stanley saw many of the men around him mangled, mutilated by the bullets and by the bombs. Then the officers ordered the men to stand up and charge. The Confederates leapt to their feet and with a great battle cry surged forwards, and although pounded by artillery, decimated by rifle fire, the men in gray charged on, sweeping through a second Union regiment. Then Stanley was knocked to the ground. When he'd recovered his breath, he discovered his belt buckle was bent, cracked, His belt buckle had stopped a Union bullet, but he was not injured. Many more charges were ordered, and time and again, the Arkansas volunteers sent the Yankees reeling back in retreat. Then, torrential rain fell upon the battlefield. As they took stock of their situation, they realized there were barely 50 men left of their regiment. As another advance was ordered, Stanley found himself isolated and surrounded by Union troops who took him prisoner. He was startled by the wild-eyed hatred and fury of the Yankees, who cursed and threatened to bayonet him. That's what happens to people who are beaten time and again. They can get quite vicious with their superior enemy, who, although outnumbered, managed to beat them time and again. He ended up in a boxcar shipped to Camp Douglas on the outskirts of Chicago. The camp was a disgusting disease factory, more like a great cattle pen filled with wounded and malnourished men who were left to die in the filth. The prisoners were denied even the most basic of hygiene medical needs. Fleas, flies, rats infested the filthy barracks. He saw vast numbers of prisoners debilitated, dying of dysentery, typhoid, fever, without the slightest aid from their heartless captors. The commissary, Mr. Shipman, persuaded Stanley to save his life by enlisting in the Union Army, but the only way he could get out of there. This he did, but 3 days after his release from prison, 4th of June in 1862, he came down with fever so severe that he was discharged for health reasons. He walked to the coast and worked on farms and on a ship bound for Liverpool, and he set out to find his mother, who told him she wanted nothing to do with him. His mother's cold hostility left him in even darker despair than her abandonment of him as a child. Stanley worked his way back across the ocean to try and find his adoptive father in Cuba. There he was devastated to learn that his father had already been dead nearly 2 years. Stanley's situation could hardly have been worse. He was homeless. He was penniless. He was without any friends or any relations. He was afflicted by parasites that he'd picked up in prison. He did not even have a country. Which country do you belong to? Wales didn't want him. America didn't want him. Stanley determined he'd never again consciously seek or expect human affection. Stanley enlisted now as a sailor and worked on merchant ships, traveling to the West Indies, to Italy and Spain. He survived a shipwreck off Barcelona, Spain. On 19th of July, 1864, Stanley enlisted in the United States Navy in New York. The naval records record him as 5 feet 5 inches in height, hazel eyes, dark hair, birthplace, England. I mean, where's Wales? Somewhere in England, obviously. So he served on board the USS North Carolina and the USS Minnesota. As he's given the chance task of being the ship's writer, he kept the log, wrote reports on land and sea battles, some of which ended being published in the newspapers. His vigorous eyewitness accounts of action, his attention detail was remarkable. And due to the positive comments that he received and the success of having these reports published, Stanley began to think of becoming a journalist. On the 10th of February, 1865, Stanley deserted the Navy and became a roving reporter in the Wild West. And this is pretty serious. He's now deserted from the Confederate Army and from the Northern Navy. He could be shot if they caught. I mean, these are very serious offenses in the time of war. It's remarkable that a man who throughout the rest of his life developed the reputation of being the most persistent, most relentless of explorers, the man who never gave up, no matter what, against all odds, in the face of any danger, that before he was 24 years old, Stanley had run away from school, jumped ship, deserted the Confederate cause by enlisting in the other side, joined the Yankees, deserted the United States Navy in a time of war. No one at that stage of his life could have anticipated what he could have accomplished in that life. I think he would have been called a loser, or the equivalent they would have used at that time in the 1860s. He traveled to Missouri, Salt Lake City, Denver, and Omaha. He built a flat-bottomed raft boat, which capsized twice. He experienced some of the Indian Wars. Then in July 1866, Stanley set sail for Smyrna in Turkey. Remember, Smyrna is one of the 7 churches of the Book of Revelation. There he was betrayed by a treacherous guide into the hands of thieves who severely beat him, stole all his money and his papers. After being arrested for not having papers, Stanley wrote an account of the abuse that he had experienced in Turkey during his time in Orient. And here's one of the adverts for these meetings. American traveler Henry Stanley, cruelly robbed by the Turks, stripped of overwhelming numbers of his arms, passport, letters of credit, over $4,000 in cash, will lecture on his travels and ventures in Turkey and life in the Orient. So at least he's able to make some money out of lecturing at this point. Then returned to the United States, he joined the expedition to Indian country by General Winfield Hancock. Now, if you've read the Killer Angels book on the Battle of Gettysburg or seen the film Gettysburg, you'll know who General Hancock was. Well, Hancock and Armistead were good friends who both wounded in the last at the Battle of Gettysburg, although General Hancock survived. Nevertheless, this is the same Hancock, veteran of Gettysburg, who's now fighting the Indian Wars. Stanley was impressed at how Hancock negotiated with the Comanche and Kiowa Indians in Nebraska and Kansas. He'd expect to see the Indians severely treated after the atrocities he'd seen committed against settlers, scalping people, stripping people, disemboweling people, all these hideous things, men, women, children. I mean, he came from a culture where you were flogged for mispronouncing a word. And here, these people who commit great atrocities were treated very graciously and gently by the U.S. cavalry. And General Hancock saw peaceful resolutions and negotiations to extend civilization rather than punish the Indians that they called savages. At one point, Stanley met Wild Bill Hickok, interviewed him. When he asked how many men he had killed, Wild Bill replied that he had killed considerably over 100 white men to a certain knowledge. Couldn't remember how many Indians, but 100 white men. I've never killed one man without a good cause. Sort of wonder what the standards of good cause was. Hickok and Stanley became friends, and when another person made an insulting remark to Stanley, Wild Bill picked the man up and threw him over a billiard table. Must have been a pretty strong man. Billiard tables are quite big. Stanley also reported on General William Sherman's dealings with the Indians in Omaha and Kansas. He later reported he had learned a great deal about how to deal with primitive people from Hancock and Sherman. Now, Sherman was one of the most savage generals in the entire U.S. Army. He's the one who did the march through Georgia, destroying, laying waste to farms, and hideous. He was a scorched earth proponent. So interesting how they could be so savage with the Confederates and with civilians, and yet so gentle on the Indians. He noted that they dealt with them both as warriors and as children, who must be taught and corrected. Stanley noted that he learned to do the same when dealing with savage tribes in Africa. While being the special correspondent of the Missouri Democrats, Stanley also contributed articles to the New York Herald, the New York Times, Chicago Republican, Cincinnati Commercial, so he's something of a freelance journalist at this stage. Despite frequenting bars and taverns where drunkenness was common, Stanley remained true to his pledge of abstinence, abstaining from alcohol for life. With only one exception, only once in his life did he drink and get drunk, which he bitterly repented of. He also lived a very disciplined life, and he saved most of what he earned. It's quite extraordinary with that background that the man didn't give himself to drink like so many others did, surrounded by it, of course, as he would be in the Army and Navy. Hearing of the upcoming British war with Abyssinia, Stanley persuaded James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald to hire him as their special correspondent to Africa. Stanley joined the British Expeditionary Force at the Red Sea port of Zula, Eritrea. King Theodoro had killed the former king, had provoked the kingdom to rebellion through his cruelty and his tyranny. Then he antagonized the British Empire by assaulting their consul, Cameron, an English missionary, Stern. And when envoys carried letters of protest from Queen Victoria, Theodoro threw the envoys, the ambassadors, into prison. He just didn't do that. It just wasn't on. The English diplomats were tortured, treated in the most horrendous ways. So after unsuccessful attempts to ransom the prisoners, Britain declared war on King Theodoro. Not on Abyssinia, but on the king. In 1869, Britain dispatched an expeditionary force of 12,000 troops of the Indian Army under Sir Robert Napier to secure the release of the hostages and to suitably punish Theodoro. And because this is the 1860s, photography was being used, and so they were able to photograph parts of this war, and the British forces coming ashore. It's a 400-mile march to Theodora's stronghold at Magdala. Stanley wrote to the colorful sight of English and Irish regiments of weather-beaten veterans and redcoats, colorful regiments of Punjabs, sepoys, and Indian cavalry, English sailors with rockets and horse-drawn artillery, elephants, camels, horses, mules. Imagine loading mortar cannons onto the backs of elephants. I mean, what a task. And on the 9th of April, Abyssinian expeditionary force arrived at Magdala, the fortress capital of Abyssinia. Apparently undaunted by the impregnable appearance of the stronghold perched on the top of a granite mountain, the British military marched across the river, proceeded up the mountain. Theodora launched 3,500 well-armed warriors down the slopes in a wild charge against the British. Calmly, Napier ordered the naval brigade take the positions, action front. The naval brigade launched their rockets in the midst of the charging Abyssinians, who were thrown to terror and confusion by these strange weapons. Then 300 men from the 4th were ordered forward, and the command was given, commence firing. And they withered away the attackers. The British surged forward. The Abyssinians attempted a flanking movement, but they were wiped out with the bayonets of the sepoys, the Indians. At the end of the day, 560 dead Abyssinians were counted in the field, but not a single British soldier had been lost, although 32 were wounded. Theodora now terrified the British firepower that he had witnessed destroying his best troops the previous day, attempted to appease the British by releasing all of his prisoners. Stanley noticed with surprise the lack of emotion expressed by both the captives, who had endured years of torment, and the liberators, who seemed all amazingly calm about the whole matter. And this would doubtless have impressed upon him that he mustn't act like an American when he met David Livingstone after walking who knows how many thousands of kilometers to find him. And that's why he opted for the very cautious Dr. Livingstone, I presume. You know, Americans might have run up and hugged the person, but he just, from his experience in Abyssinia, he thought he doesn't want to embarrass himself from the British, so he's going to opt for the safer, more formal approach. The next morning, the British marched up the mountain, began an artillery barrage on the stronghold. This was followed by an assault, and soon the British flags were hoisted on the walls, and the bands were playing God Save the Queen. Emperor Theodora then shot himself, and here's the very reason why they'd come on this operation. And this is typical British, presenting arms to salute the savage king that they'd come to punish. This is what the British did at the end of the Anglo-Zulu War in 1879, when King Kishwayo had inflicted on the British the worst defeat they ever suffered at the hands of a native army at Isandlwana. When he was captured, the officer commanding ordered the regiment to present arms, and they saluted and gave a royal salute to Kishwayo as he entered into captivity to be transported to Cape Town to be imprisoned in the castle. Photography of Magdala, the mountain fortress, and the British camps in the foreground. You can see the white tents and formidable, rough, tough, savage area. These troops look like they haven't had a bath in months. And these are the people who fought at Magdala, all part of the British expeditionary force to Abyssinia. Gives you a bit of a glimpse through time, through this black and white photography. The British forces camped at the base of this mountain fortress, and Indian troops lined up ready for battle. They had to get up pretty steep inclines, and there's the mountain redoubt of the king. That's pretty hard to take, but take it they did. And here you can see the king's last redoubt in the inaccessible part. The British took a picture before the engineers blew it all up. Incredibly, no British soldiers died in the final assault either. 2 days later, Magdala was blown up by the engineers, and on the 18th of April, 1868, the British expeditionary force started back to the coast. They'd liberated the hostages, seen a king killed, and destroyed his capital. So young Stanley wrote, and thus the modern crusade became numbered with past events, to be remembered of all men in all lands amongst the most wonderfully successful campaigns ever conducted in history. a lot more successful in the things America does these days. Just think of Afghanistan. Key thing is, achieve your objective and go home. Don't stay there for 20 years making enemies. When Stanley arrived in Suez, he had a story wired to London and then on to New York Herald. By the way, he took the precaution of bribing the man at the telex office not to send anyone else's news releases first. So he got the scoop, and they delayed a few days on the other one. So he knew the right people to get to, and therefore his was the first news story of the campaign to be published, and it established his reputation worldwide. Stanley was now made a journalist of New York Herald with a $2,000 a year salary, which was phenomenal. I mean, he's now established as one of the most effective journalists around. That's a princely sum at that time. Stanley's next assignment was to cover the rebellion, more like civil war, in Spain. From there, he is tasked to find the great African explorer and missionary, Dr. David Livingstone. No word had been heard of David Livingstone since he last entered the Dark Continent, on what became known as the Third Missionary Journey. Like the Apostle Paul, David Livingstone had three missionary journeys. It might be added that while David Livingstone was a great hero at the end of his first missionary journey, and he was received by the Royal Geographic Society and Queen Victoria at the palace itself, and he was given awards everywhere and cheering crowds, and people welcomed and saw him off in great numbers. When he left for his third missionary journey, there wasn't a soul to see him off. In fact, no one welcomed him from his second missionary journey because he had been preceded by all the European volunteers who served with him on his second missionary journey, deserted early, gave up for different reasons, resigned, saying you can't work with David Livingstone, he's impossible. And so he came back to yesterday's hero. Nobody wanted to see him, nobody wanted to welcome him, nobody wanted to listen to him. And he left a third missionary journey, not a soul walked David Livingstone to the dock or saw him off on his third and last journey to Africa. So interesting. Now, a bit of guilt might be seeping in because they didn't know what had happened to David Livingstone. Stanley noted that the thing he hated the most was waiting. The more tasks I receive, the happier is my life. I want work so that there will be no time for regrets and vain desires and morbid thoughts. In the interval, books come in handy. He worked and he read. Although Stanley loved absorbing knowledge, he admitted he also had a craze for action. We'd call him an adrenaline junkie these days. He observed that his sufferings drove him to prove himself on the path of success. Stanley noted by intense application to duty, to self-denial, he drove himself that I might do my duty thoroughly. Stern duty commands me. He was duty orientated. Stanley had come through the fires determined to succeed, no matter what the odds. He had a tenacious, insatiable desire to succeed and not give up, as he had done in the early part of his life. With his quick mind and his retentive memory, languages came easily to him. He taught himself French and Swahili, some Arabic, dozens of African dialects to some degree. And then on the 27th of October, 1869, he received one of the most extraordinary assignments ever entrusted to a newspaper reporter. Has there ever been an assignment to compare with this? James Gordon Bennett Jr. of New York Herald commissioned Stanley to go to Central Africa and to learn anything and everything he could about Dr. David Livingstone and to find him. But first, he instructs Stanley, go and cover the inauguration of the Suez Canal, which is cutting travel time. You don't have to go around the Cape of Good Hope. You can go straight from Europe through the Mediterranean, through the Suez Canal, the Red Sea to get to India and Australia and so on. Then proceed up the Nile, find out about Sir Baker's expedition. Then travel to Jerusalem, to Constantinople, and visit the Crimea and the Karakoids and Baghdad and Persepolis. Persepolis was where Queen Esther was in the capital of Persia. After that, go to India. Then go to Zanzibar, and from there, go to find David Livingstone. Oh, that all. Draw £1,000 now. When you've gone through that, draw another 1,000. When that is spent, draw another. And when you finish that, draw another 1,000, and so on. But find Livingstone. Stanley declared that he would do everything that a human being could possibly do, and beyond that, he would trust in God to enable him to do even more. Stanley immediately that night set out on a whirlwind tour of the Middle East, covering the opening of the Suez Canal at Port Said. He explored the Holy Place in Jerusalem, of course, writing articles on each of these things and wiring them back to New York each time. He walked to the old battlefields of the Crimean War. He reported on the Russian civilizing mission in Baku. Then the exotic bazaars of Tehran and Persia, to the ruins of Persepolis, where he engaged in some graffiti. And you can still see the photograph of this etching, Stanley, New York Herald, 1870. Then India, off to Zanzibar in Africa. Throughout this incredible journey, Stanley read everything he could find about David Livingstone and other explorers of Africa, like John Haddings Spink. He arrived in Zanzibar 6th of January, 1871. Despite the tremendous discoveries of Dr. David Livingstone, the vast interior of the continent was still mostly unknown at this stage. Most of its mountains, lakes, rivers, and forests were still unexplored. Now, before Livingstone, before 1841, the general consensus amongst geographers was that the vast hinterland of Africa was one big desert. They assumed it was desert because they didn't know anything about it. And it's David Livingstone who filled it in. No, there's mountains and plateaus and rivers and lakes and so much more. Well, at that stage, there was still a lot of Africa unexplored territory, just vague. Some maps had palm trees and elephants in the middle because they didn't know what else to put in the map. Most of the tribes inhabiting the interior of Africa were still unknown. Many maps at that time had words like unknown and unexplored territory written across huge sections of the interior of Africa. Stanley immediately saw that slaves and ivory were the primary export of Africa, being brought out of the interior by unscrupulous Arab traders. At Zanzibar, these are the kind of sketches made and some of the photography of slave trading and ivory. They would shoot the elephants and then enslave a bunch of people to carry the ivory to the coast. Ivory and slaves. The Arabs in Zanzibar regarded Africa as a source of seemingly unlimited numbers of slaves and elephant tusks. In June 1856, Richard Burton, not the actor, this is the real Richard Burton of long ago, a very pagan man actually, and John Haddings Peake, who was a Christian gentleman, had set out from Zanzibar to find the source of the Nile. When Burton had fallen sick, Speke set out on his own and discovered and named Lake Victoria as the source of the Nile. It indeed is one of the sources, and the greatest source of the Nile, but it's not the only source of the Nile, but he was not to know that at that stage. Burton became Speke's bitter enemy and disputed his findings because he wasn't there. Therefore, Speke set out with James Grant in 1860 to confirm that Lake Victoria was indeed the source of the Nile. Burton, Speke, Grant, Baker. They had all established their reputations as African explorers. But the explorer that surpassed them all was the Scottish missionary, Dr. David Livingstone. Here, David Livingstone is depicted with the arrow pointing with his consular cap at a debate which was set. They were waiting for John Haddings Peake to arrive to debate Richard Burton on the source of Nile. But the debate never happened because John Haddings Peake accidentally shot himself during a hunting incident before, and this debate, which was expected to be the great debate, and the chairman of the debate was going to be David Livingstone, sadly never happened. For over 20 years, David Livingstone had walked from Africa, across Africa, from coast to coast, across the Kalahari Desert. He discovered Lake Ngami, Victoria Falls, one of the greatest cataracts in the world, Lake Malawi, and many other previously unknown features of the continent. Dr. Livingstone was a tireless crusader against the slave trade. At 52 years old, Livingstone left England for the last time, 14th of August, 1865, without a soul seeing him off. Starting from Zanzibar, he proceeded to the mouth of the Rovuma River. From there, he went to explore Lake Malawi. In December 1866, some deserters from his porters returned to Zanzibar with news that Livingstone was dead. The world mourned his passing, but some doubted the reports. Actually, they were liars and thieves. They had deserted David Livingstone, stole so much of his provisions, reported him dead so that the British would pay them their back pay for having worked with David Livingstone, although they'd actually looted his, terribly looted his provisions, were more than compensated, but they managed to get away with this for a few years before their lie was uncovered. When letters from Livingstone dated February 1867 and July 1868 were brought out of the interior, it created a sensation. a word about postal service back then. You didn't have postage stamps and you didn't have a postal service as such. The way it worked in Africa and all over the world, really, was that people take a letter, fold it over, address on the outside of the letter itself was its envelope, and leave it under the postal rock or in the postal tree crevice, and the next person passing by, yeah, I'm going that direction, they'll leave their letters there that someone going the other direction will deliver. It was an honor system. Interestingly enough, John Newton, the one who wrote Amazing Grace, he numbered his letters, and his 20-something years as a naval captain and sailor, he always wrote to his wife, and would you believe it, every letter arrived. And that's postal rocks and postal trees all over the world, islands and what have you. Some of them took months to get there, but they still got there quicker than our postal service in South Africa delivers some things these days. We just got something posted from Cape Town in July, just arrived today. So James Gordon Bennett believed it would be a tremendous story if this famous missionary explorer could be found and interviewed. What a scoop for the New York Herald. Henry Morton Stanley was only 29 years old when he began his expedition to find Livingstone. He had never before led or organized an expedition. He had never been a leader or an employer of men. Yet his wide reading and his varied experiences in travel all seemed to have prepared him for this challenge. He had to spend over $20,000 on this expedition, including purchasing millions of beads, miles of wire, copper, and cloth, which was needed for payment to cross tribal territories and to barter for food and other items in the interior. If you think that taxes and customs duty is a fruit of colonialism, think again. It existed long before the blasted colonials came in and gave more bureaucracy to it. To cross any chief's territory, any tribe's territory, you had to pay a fortune and all sorts of things. And what they wanted was, these guys wanted these kind of beads. These wanted these color beads. These wanted this size beads. Those wanted that size beads. These want this kind of copper wire of this thickness. These want this kind of copper wire of that thickness. And he had to plan ahead what he needed, what type of cloth. This kind of cloth prized amongst these tribes, but not amongst those. And this kind of cloth is the most effective here. And he had to plan all this. Now, how did he know? By reading Grant, Speke, Burton, Livingstone, anybody who had traveled Africa and working it out. And then he hired the guides and the staff who had worked for previous explorers. So he knew how to make this work. He located six Africans who had served the explorers Burton, Speke, and Grant, including Mabruki and Bombay. Bombay is pictured here, who was made captain of the Askaris. Stanley purchased 20 donkeys. He could have saved himself the trouble if he had paid attention. The donkeys would not survive the tsetse fly. Two boats that they could fold up, of course, dismantle. Tents, vast quantities of food, medicine, clothing, arms, and ammunition. In fact, it's an extraordinary operation. The supplies were packed in bales and bags and boxes, and none could weigh more than 30 kilograms. In fact, because everything had to be carried by porters. Well, he must have had tougher people than I've had. When I've gone expeditions into Nuba Mountains, our maximum was 23 kgs. I mean, 30 kgs, I don't think our guys would have managed that. You know, going up mountains and up and down and over through rivers. So we had 23 kgs as our limit for boxes. But he had 30 kgs. And that meant repackaging things, making sure that weight was right. Because the pagazis who carried things, the porters, that was their limit. And as the supplies needed to last for at least 2 years, great pains and foresight had to be shown every aspect of preparation. You couldn't carry enough food, but you got to carry enough trading items to barter for food, or fishing gear and rifles to hunt enough food en route and so on. 6 tons of material needed to be carried to the interior. The most I've ever handled in one expedition is 4 tons. 4 tons in Nuba Mountains, that required 240 people, counting soldiers, escorts, and those carrying. Well, he needed more than that. 6 tons of material to be carried to the interior. Ujiji, on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, over 742 miles, over 1,000 kilometers inland from the coast, was the last location Livingstone had been heard from. So Stanley would go there first, and from there, he'd try and find out where he'd gone since. Stanley recruited 2 other white men, who honestly were worthless. In fact, they were worse than worthless. 23 askaris, 157 pagazis. Askaris are soldiers, escorts. 157 pagazis, four chiefs, five additional men with different duties like cook, Arabic interpreter, and so on. A total of 192 men. At the beginning, they had two horses, 27 donkeys, none of which survived the tsetse fly. Their baggage was 116 loads, packages for the pagazi. Weapons were one shotgun, two carbines, four rifles, eight pistols, 24 flintlock muskets, two swords, two daggers, two axes, 24 hatchets, 24 long knives. At first, the terrain was rough savanna. The climate was hot, humid, temperatures over 128 degrees Fahrenheit in the 30s and 40s Celsius. As the rainy seasons came, the rivers swelled, animals and men bogged down marsh and mud. Every river crossing required much ingenuity and hard work, especially if you don't want to lose or ruin your baggage. Tsetse flies and mosquitoes and every other kind of insect afflicted the men, leeches and all of that, and the animals of the column. In the 13 months of this expedition, Stanley was laid low by fever on 23 occasions. Dysentery, smallpox, malaria, other unknown fevers afflicted everyone on the expedition. Everyone got sick. The first casualty was one of the white team members, William Farquhar, who died early on in the expedition. Every day presented new problems to be solved. Stanley soon learned that leadership required discipline, organization, morale, motivation, conflict resolution, and a lot of communication. Many of the men contractors, porters deserted, stealing or losing the goods they were carrying. It was a never-ending struggle to keep the column together and to keep them moving forwards. This famous illustration of him threatening to shoot a porter if he dared drop that box. Actually, that's an example of something he had learned, that porters were inclined with heavy baggage to empty the contents, like the medicine chest of David Livingstone on a second missionary journey was emptied into the Zambezi River to make it lighter. And that's why Livingstone's wife died in the Zambezian tip, because all the medicines were ditched by these lazy porters who didn't want to carry all that extra weight. So when the emergency came, they didn't have it. And he knew that. He had read about these on the second missionary journey. And when he saw this man preparing to ditch the box, he threatened him. This is just one incident of many. Every chief demanded tribute for the travelers to pass through their territory. Yet despite the many frustrations and delays, Stanley's column achieved a rapid advance twice as fast as the column of Burton and Speke, who were meant to be the experts, the old hands, the ones who had done this so many times before. There was a battle at Marumbo, massive battle, more like a war actually. Most of his men were so frightened they refused to go any further. The other white man on the expedition, Shaw, became demoralized, completely worthless at this point. Many men deserted the column, mutiny erupted. Here's a grave many years later for Shaw. They didn't have a metal plaque from then. This was installed later on to remember his second European companion who was buried in Tanganyika. Stanley loaded both barrels of his shotgun, adjusted his revolvers for ready action, walked towards rebellious men who picked up their muskets in a threatening way. Stanley raised the shotgun, aimed directly at the heads, and commander instantly dropped their weapons. Asmani did not obey. Stanley knocked him to the ground. In this way, the mutiny was quelled. Stanley compelled all those who would remain with him to swear a solemn promise to faithfully remain under his command until they'd found Livingstone. And despite many of the troubles and starvation that plagued the expedition, the men remained faithful to this pledge thereafter. Then they met a native caravan coming from Ujiji. They spoke out a white man with grey hair who had just arrived. Was he ever at Ujiji before, Stanley asked? Yes, but he went away a long time ago. Stanley was overwhelmed with excitement and impatience. How many white men with grey hair could there be in the middle of Africa? Stanley pulled out his new flannel suit, had his Wellington boots polished, his helmet chalked, folded a fresh pangee cloth around it. On Friday the 10th of November, 1871, on the 236th day of their expedition, after having departed Bagamoyo on the coast, Stanley ordered his flag unfurled. With Asmani leading with the American flag, Stanley ordered the guns fired to announce their arrival. Susie and Truma, the faithful servants of Livingstone, met them on the path. Livingstone had rescued both of them from slavery. And they ran back to inform Dr. Livingstone that a white man was coming with a strange flag that they had never seen before. as the only two white men in all of Equatorial Africa from the Zambezi to the Nile met near the shores of Lake Tanganyika. Stanley walked deliberately towards the older man, took off his hat and said, Dr. Livingston, I presume. And David Livingston tipped his hat and said, yes. And then Stanley shook hands, declaring, I thank God, doctor, that I've been permitted to see you. Livingston replied, I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you. Stanley then offered Livingston a packet of letters from his family and friends at home, expecting him to read them immediately, you would expect. However, Dr. Livingston put them to one side and said, as I've been waiting years for letters, I've been taught patience. I can surely afford to wait a few hours longer. Now tell me the general news, how's the world getting on? Well, he's asking a journalist. Stanley gave him an update on the opening of the Suez Canal. General Grant's now president of the United States. Pacific Railroad across the continent of America has been completed. The Spanish Revolution has driven Queen Isabella from the throne. Prussia has defeated Denmark and France in war. In Prussia was an unknown entity before that. Now, France and Denmark, major superpowers, have been defeated by Prussia. The first Atlantic cable has been laid, permitting immediate communication between North America and Europe. And diamonds have been discovered in South Africa. And at this, David Livingston smiled and said, I wondered how long it would take them. What do you mean? Well, David Livingston had discovered diamonds 24 years before in Northern Cape. He had been walking Northern Cape. He'd found diamonds, picked them up, and threw them into the bush. Now, here's pictures of 1973 diamond mines in Kimberley, workers at the end of a shift, and this phenomenal network of wires stretching to different claims and buckets being moved backwards and forwards. And the hysteria, people, the diamond rush, the diamond fever, hysterical. And David Livingston found diamonds in what today is Northern Cape and threw them into the bush and said nothing about it. And so Henry Wharton Stanley asked, why didn't you sell the diamonds? I said, I couldn't do that. We were preparing to evangelize and disciple the Tswana people. We hadn't even built the first church yet. It would have destroyed the Tswana people to have all these rough miners coming in with their vice and drunkenness and gambling. We needed to still evangelize them. So, no, I couldn't do that. I've got here, this is a model of the Cullinan diamond, the largest diamond found in South Africa. And it's normally in that display case there. It's a model. It's not a real diamond. But this just reminds one of how David Livingston, he had found a pearl of great price and he wasn't going to waste his time on diamonds. And so imagine the discipline. 24 odd years, not a word. Not a soul knew about it until they discovered it. And he knew it was inevitable, but by then, hopefully the Tswana church would be established. And the discipline, so Stanley said, why didn't you just take some of them back to Scotland and sell them in England? He said, people knew where I worked. They would have torn the place apart. These are the best diamonds. He knew geology. He understood all these things. It was well read. And so he literally picked up the diamonds and threw them in a bush and said nothing about it. How's that for discipline and focus? It just makes you think more of what type of person David Livingston was. Well, from his side, Dr. Livingston reported that Henry Morton Stanley had arrived at the most opportune time. Arab slavers had robbed him of all of his supplies. He was desperate, he was sick, he was destitute. Interesting that David Livingston's prayers were answered by a man who had to set out months before he was in a situation that needed help. All the forces that were working there to answer his prayers were set in place long before he even prayed those prayers or needed those resupplies. Just extraordinary. The friendship that began so formally grew and deepened over the next 4 months that they were in daily contact. Stanley later reported he is surprised and captivated by the courtesy and dignity and patience and high morals of David Livingston. Bear in mind, Henry Morton Stanley had a rough upbringing. Stanley was cynical. He was skeptical. He was secular. He, in fact, said, I started out like an elephant hunter with Livingston in my sights. I was going to write a report to expose this religious hypocrite, and as he expected all religious leaders to be. He was expecting to be able to do an expose on Livingston. And instead, he was shocked to find this man's the real deal. Writing of Livingston later in life, Stanley wrote, lowly of spirit, meek in speech, merciful of heart, pure in mind, peaceful in act. During health or sickness, he was consistently noble, upright, pious, and manly. In all the days of my companionship with him, and Livingston's patience and perseverance impressed Stanley the most. Stanley felt convicted of the fact that up until then he had tended to solve his problems by running away from them. However, this time he had succeeded in facing his difficulties boldly and overcoming them. Stanley determined to never again run away from anything. Together, Stanley and Livingston now undertook an expedition by boat around the northern end of Lake Tanganyika. Finally, when Stanley had to return, Livingston entrusted him with a box filled with his letters, diaries, scientific and geographic research, and many other papers. And on the 14th of March, 1872, they parted. Here's a woodcut that marks this parting, which must have been very hard for both of them to do. After resupplying Livingston with all the trading goods he could need, Stanley's column had much less to transport back to the coast. He literally put everything in one pile, divided it exactly evenly, gave half to Livingston's group. And that was absolutely essential for Livingston. So he had determined he would resupply him. And you can imagine, when this got back to Britain, the people in Britain felt ashamed. They had abandoned their explorer, and it was an American journalist who resupplied Livingston, and the British were actually quite humiliated by that. Stanley's people now marched in rain and trudged in mud up to the knees and crossed innumerable rivers and streams, and finally on the 6th of May, only 54 days after leaving Tabora, they reached Bagamoyo on the coast, which is pretty close to where Dar es Salaam is today. There, Stanley met Lieutenant William Henn of the Royal Navy, leading the Livingston Search and Relief Expedition sent out by the Royal Geographic Society. Dollar short and a day late, as they would say. That expedition ended before it had even begun, because they were then informed. Actually, we found him and resupplied him, and the Royal Navy decided to go back home. That expedition gave up. Stanley had now walked 2,250 miles in 411 days across very harsh terrain. 20 members of the expedition had died during this epic journey. Stanley is quite tough. Every journey he ever undertook, all the Europeans on his expedition died. He's the only one who'd survive. Just standard. So he must have been a particularly tough, resilient person. I suppose if you've survived the workhouse, you could survive anything. So this is his journey to and from. I should say, the lower dots are Livingston's journey around Lake Malawi, up around Lake Benguela, and up across Lake Tanganyika, whereas the straight one there is Stanley's journey. So that's basically intriguing. Stanley must have been guided by the Lord, because that's a huge area that he had to cover. Stanley was completely unprepared for the response he would receive in Europe. The Paris Geographic Society condemned him as an impostor. Many French newspapers held his achievements in extravagant terms, comparing it to Napoleon's march through the Alps. The people in England responded to Stanley's exploits with intense interest and excitement. But the Standard and the Spectator expressed suspicions and misgivings of the genuineness of the report. Some claimed Stanley had not even been to Africa at all. Sensational stories and speculations abounded. The sudden fame and unexpected suspicions and vicious attacks upon his character and the unfair criticisms of David Livingston disillusioned Stanley and made him want to recoil from human society even more. Stanley wrote that his belief that toil, generosity, devotion to duty, and righteous living would receive recognition at the hands of my fellow creatures was shattered. After all that, to have people just dismiss him and disbelieve him was shattering. However, when Livingston's family confirmed beyond question the authenticity of the letters and the papers which Stanley had brought back, all charges of forgery were withdrawn, and the Times, the Daily News, and Daily Telegraph and Punch declared Stanley a true hero and actually apologized publicly for their earlier misgivings. Here's the London Illustrate News showing Stanley being welcomed in the streets with much fanfare and flags and people tipping their hats to him. Lord Granville, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, presented Stanley with a gold box with 5 dozen diamonds as an expression of appreciation from Her Majesty Queen Victoria in recognition of the prudence and zeal displayed by him in opening communication with Dr. Livingstone, the same kind of diamonds that Livingstone threw into the bush. He was later received by Queen Victoria. Considering he was from the lowest of the low, he was at the bottom of British society, that he's now honoured by the Queen, remarkable. He was also honoured by the Royal Geographic Society, who presented him with the Victoria Medal and offered public apology for their conduct towards him earlier. In Scotland, Daniel was awarded another medal, made an honorary citizen. So from man without a country, now had several countries. The completion and publication of Stanley's book, How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa, was achieved only 3 months after his arrival in Europe. It became an instant bestseller. This is another proof he didn't have a social life, that he could produce books like this. But also, he, of course, had kept a journal and took impeccable notes throughout. And so every evening he's writing things down. If he hadn't done that, he couldn't have produced his book. I've been through every word of this book, and I tell you, it's exhausting what he went through. And just reading the book is exhausting. Forget about doing the expedition. Stanley began to receive a flood of letters from strangers, relatives, and acquaintances from his early years who were suddenly affectionate towards orphan who they had once spurned. In fact, Denbrey, where he was born, put up a monument to him in town depicting his famous meeting with David Livingstone, right by the church. And St. Asaph's actually put a memento to Stanley on the walls of this orphanage where they had once whipped and flogged and beaten and caned him. How's that for irony? And here is the valley where he was born, Henry Morton Stanley, 1841 to 1904, explorer of Africa, born educated, educated in the valley of Clyde, buried at Prigbright. So, interesting, as they say, failure is an orphan, but success has many parents. So, if you succeed, a lot of people take credit and know you. If you fail, well, nobody ever knew you in the first place. Sailing into New York, Stanley was received with great fanfare and a warm welcome by the entire staff of the Herald. Well, almost the entire staff, just the proprietor was missing. James Gordon Bennett Jr., the one who'd actually sent him to Africa, sat sulking in his office and refused to come out and welcome back. His reporter's fame provoked deep displeasure, which developed into jealousy and later hatred as Stanley returned from other expeditions and achieved even greater exploits. And Bennett's hatred lasted as long as Stanley lived. Sadly, sad that some people can't take joy in another's accomplishments, which in a real way he was part of, because he's the one who sent him and financed it. In fact, his book, How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa, is dedicated to Gordon Bennett. Receptions and banquets and cheers and applause resounded throughout Stanley's triumphal procession throughout the United States, which also is amazing, considering he's the only man I know who fought on both sides of the war and who deserted from both armies. And now he's being received back in a country where he could have easily been put against a wall and shot for those crimes. Dr. Livingstone's elder brother, John, who lived in Canada, came to New York to thank Stanley personally for what he'd done for his brother. Author Mark Twain praised Stanley extravagantly, comparing him to Christopher Columbus. What he said is, Christopher Columbus actually didn't have as tough a job as Stanley, which is true. I mean, Christopher Columbus just has to sail westwards and inevitably he's going to find the continent. But Stanley had to find one person in the midst of a vast continent, which is three times bigger than the United States. When Bennett sent Stanley to cover the war in Spain, probably hoping he'd get shot there, he found it a welcome relief from the round of banquets and lectures and receptions and honors and controversy and criticisms which had come at him relentlessly since his return from Africa. Then England embarked on another military expedition to Africa, this time to punish the Ashantis, who had massacred 600 British citizens. Major General Sir Garnet Wolseley, who's a veteran of the Anglo-Zulu War later, was in command of this expedition to what is today Ghana. The year was 1873. Stanley wrote, "The people are as barbarous, untutored, and superstitious, as wild in appearance, as naked in body, as filthy in the habits, as any tribe of savages I've ever seen." Stanley described the grisly march, encountering human sacrifices, severed heads on poles in every village they marched through. At Kumasi, Stanley located the killing fields of King Kofi of the Ashanti, a sacred grove where prisoners and slaves had been sacrificed. The terrible stench of decomposing corpses was overwhelming. 30 or more decapitated bodies in the last stage of decomposition were immediately visible. Skulls were piled high. Stanley calculated that the grove contained the skulls of over 120,000 people. The British Army fought three battles against the Ashanti, but while nothing in Stanley's account of the expedition indicates that he took any personal share in the fighting, Lord Wolseley's memoirs describes Henry Stanley thus: a thoroughly good man. No noise, no danger ruffled his nerve. He looked as cool and self-possessed as if he had been at target practice. Time after time, as I turned in his direction, I saw him go down in a kneeling position to steady his rifle as he applied the most daring of the enemy with a never-failing aim. The close-shut lips, the determined expression of his manly face told plainly. No danger could appall. The cool, unflinching manliness gave fresh courage. I've been somewhat previously prejudiced against him, but all such feelings were slain and buried at Amoful. Ever since, I've been proud to reckon him amongst the bravest of my brave comrades. Now this from an English gentleman, general, for a journalist, an American at that, that's high praise. They were received back with great honour, and Stanley published his account of the British military campaigns in Abyssinia and Ashanti under the title Kumasi and Magdala, combined the two. It was while returning from the Ashanti War that Stanley heard of the death of Dr. David Livingstone. Now, he had tried to urge him to come back to England with him, but Livingstone said, I must find the Nile, I must finish my mission in Africa. He refused to return to safety. Stanley wrote, Dear Livingstone, another sacrifice for Africa. His mission, however, must not be allowed to cease. Others must go forward and fill the gap. May I be selected to succeed him in opening up Africa to the light of Christianity. May Livingstone's God be with me. May God direct me as he wills. I can only vow to be obedient and not to slacken. Some people criticized Livingstone as the missionary without a convert, which was not true. Livingstone had converts, but his standards were so high, he wouldn't accept someone who didn't abandon polygamy, for example, as a true convert, things like that. And so Stanley said, what do you mean he had no convert? I'm one of his converts. I went to Africa as an infidel, came back as a Christian. Stanley now saw Africa as a challenge, Livingstone as his example and his inspiration. Stanley dedicated his life to serving Africa by developing Christianity and civilization throughout its vast, unexplored interior. On the 18th of April, 1874, Henry Morton Stanley was one of the pallbearers for the funeral of Dr. David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey. Stanley was given the foremost position on the right. Shortly after that, the Daily Telegraph London and New York Herald united to fund an expedition to Central Africa under the leadership of Henry Stanley to complete the work left unfinished by the lamentable death of Dr. Livingstone, to solve, if possible, the remaining problems of the geography of Central Africa, and to investigate and report upon the haunts of the slave traders. And so Henry Morton Stanley had not completed his great work. He is just beginning it. In fact, the second part of his life's work after the death of David Livingstone is even more incredible, vastly more dangerous and more spectacular in achievements than the first part. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Now, some of my sources, I've studied books like How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa. We actually have his other book, which serves the basis of the next presentation. I'm in Darkest Africa. We've got first editions downstairs. There's other great books on Henry Morton Stanley, some of which are in the Rhodesia Library right here. And these are tremendous first edition sources on Stanley's Africa, the British expedition to Abyssinia. Interesting how this book on world explorers says Henry Stanley selected out of all the European explorers as, I mean, he was the greatest explorer. And I've also read his autobiography as well. Of course, we've got summaries on the great missionaries like David Livingstone, the greatest century missions, which is just meant to whet your appetite. There's also, in our video library downstairs, Stanley and Livingston film. It's a 1930s film. It's not bad. I mean, it's friendly and respectful, but it's so ahistorical, it just frustrates one. It's obvious that the film stars were all in California for the whole thing. They do have African scenes, but it's always at a distance, and you see the wildlife and so on. And they had an African film crew that went and filmed Tanganyika and so on. But plainly, all the actor scenes are done in California, that's Hollywood. Also, they just inject a lot of fake historical things in that just aren't there. And you would have thought if they could have just stuck to the actual story, you can't beat the facts. And so it's a typical case where truth is better than fiction. It's a respectful film on Stanley Livingston, but really deserves something that's actually based on what really happened, instead of fictional imagination of what Hollywood thinks everything should be and ignoring the real story.